Hello there! This show contains material which a truly free society would neither fear nor suppress. The language and concepts contained herein will not cause eternal torment in the place where the guy with the horns and pointed stick conducts his business.
John!
Hello, Bull.
What's going on, man?
That routine never gets old.
A string of Peloponnese.
We're finally recording.
Yeah.
7 hours later.
It seems we always have a technical challenge before every show. It's either an audio technical challenge or a computer technical challenge. In fact, if Lech Kowalski were here right now, he could say, he could actually utter the words, "Your Macintosh is finally working."
Right.
Remember, he kept saying, you know, the Mac is here, it's beautiful, it's not working, but it looks very nice.
Right.
And of course, by working, he meant getting on the internet.
Right, right.
And now we're on the internet.
We have the inner tubes.
We have the inner tubes in my studio via the airwaves. The miracle of the miracle of electromagnetic radiation.
Yep, we're being irradiated right now, and it's coming from underneath us, so we're probably sterile.
Yeah, that's right. You know,
I'm all set though. Got those kids out of the way.
That's right. Now you're good. You're like Lance. You put a little in the bank. They cut it out. They cut them off. You're good.
I've got none at the bank. Mine are all out there in the world.
That's it. No more.
None in the bank. I didn't store any in cryogenic freeze.
No, he had to though because he was getting the surgery.
He was getting his Teflon nut.
Well, he had something removed. He got irradiated. He had all kinds of stuff. Sterility was one of the outcomes, so they made sure that he made a little deposit in the sperm bank before he was suddenly rendered sterile.
Yeah, what would that be called? What would be the analogy? What would be the financial analogy to that? I mean, if we're talking about the sperm bank, wouldn't that be kind of like he put some in his liquid 401k, something like that?
Something like that. He made a deposit anyway, you know.
Did he have employer contributions, matching contributions
on
that one?
Yeah, there's an interesting question, yeah. Yeah, that's a good one.
Need to supplement his seed. Okay, I don't know where this is going.
I don't know where it's going either, but let's kill the metaphor.
Okay. Hey, let's talk about some artwork.
What artwork?
So from your point of view, I believe it's the violent violence invoking or violence.
To me, it's obvious. I mean, right? We have this cartoon that got published in the New York Post.
It was the Post. High quality literature, the Post is.
Well, yeah.
Highbrow.
Well, great sports anyway. That's about it. That's where it begins and ends with the Post. You
probably.
Know? It's one step below the Inquirer and, you know, one step above Jerry Springer and one step below the Inquirer.
It's like one of those British tabloids, like Page Three, boobies.
It's walking the fine line of crapdom.
It's shaped like a magazine.
And it's printed on paper, so it roughly resembles like a periodical.
It comes out in periodic waves, so I guess it would be a
periodical. You all know about this. I don't know if our listeners abroad, you know, have heard about this. I imagine they have. It's been all the rage. There was a cartoon published in the Post, and it depicted a monkey, a bullet-riddled monkey, and the caption was, you know,
there were two police officers
with smoking guns, and they said, now they'll have to, I guess I should have looked up the equipment.
We'll have to find someone else to draft the next stimulus package.
You know, everybody was up in arms about this being racist, and it is. Now, see, what I didn't know until today, though, was that apparently some monkey was killed in New York City or something. What do you know about that?
Here's the deal. I don't know the actual story behind that. I don't even care about that. That was another one of those tabloid-type things. Horrible thing for the person, but there was someone who had like a chimpanzee as a pet, and apparently the chimpanzee got out of hand, as you know wild animals tend to do, and it didn't want to take its Xanax or something, and what ended up happening is it attacked its owner or a friend of the owner, was ripping its face off, and then they had to call the police and they had to shoot the monkey dead. So what the political cartoonist was trying to do is tie in two current events. You know, we've got a stimulus package being written who a lot of people thought was not being written well, But that was one opinion. And then you have this thing where a monkey was going crazy and had to be shot. So they said, I guess what the cartoon was trying to say is...
It was a hybrid.
The stimulus package was a shambles because it was written by a monkey, meaning, you know, they just let some animal loose on it. And it
yeah, but I'm...
But wait, wait, yeah, this is the one opinion. I'm not saying this is the way it's supposed to be or the way it was interpreted. It was written by some crazy wild monkey that, you know, it was a piece of crap and they had to shoot the monkey because it was getting out of hand. And then they're going to find someone else to write the stimulus package. Now, the implication is because in American history, in racial American history...
Wasn't this my topic?
African Americans were considered or called monkeys, you know?
Yeah, one of the many slurs, racial slurs, that have been used over the years. There was a famous sportscaster named Howard Cosell, speaking of sports.
Yeah.
There was a Monday Night Football broadcast. It was about 1981 or 1982, and there was some running back or some wide receiver made a great catch and was running down the field, and Cosell said, "Look at that little monkey run."
Yeah.
And that basically got him booted off Monday Night Football. However, the reality is, if you went back and looked at the tapes of all the Monday Night Footballs that Cosell did, he used that phrase to describe any wily runner. It didn't matter what their color was. I really believe Cosell probably wasn't making a racist mark, because when a white guy caught the ball and ran with it, he would often say, "Look at that monkey run, too." He was just implying that the guy's quick and wiry and wily, like the coyote. But anyway, monkey is a classic slur for African Americans in this country. And Rupert, now when you combine this with the fact that the Post is owned by right-wing nut job Rupert freaking Murdoch,
right,
who does not approve of Obama, and I'm certain spent millions in certainly thousands, tens of thousands in campaign contributions to McCain's campaign.
He probably set up shadow corporations just so that
he could donate. Yeah, I mean, Rupert Murdoch is a right-wing freaking nut job. I mean,
he's
as crazy
Fox
as they.
He's as crazy as
they get. Now, with that bit of knowledge, we look at this comic strip in comic. It's a single frame comic, and we see, you know, a monkey being riddled with bullets, and them saying, "Looks like somebody else will have to write the next stimulus package." I'm sorry, John doesn't agree, but I see that as a threatening remark. Either, you know, watch your place, boy, or you're going to get put in your place by somebody eventually. I mean, this is the kind of thing that I really think the Secret Service needs to investigate the guy who wrote this cartoon. I mean, they need to talk to this guy and find out, you know, seriously, you know,
I don't think it's threatening, but I think it's absolutely racist.
Oh,
that's
God.
About it.
I so see the threat there. I mean, am I crazy?
Yes.
No, I'm not.
The answer is yes, sir.
No, it's as plain as the acne
giant
on your face.
The giant, humongous nose on my face, yeah.
It's as plain as the herpes sore on your lip.
It's not a herpes sore. I tripped. I fell down the stairs.
I got hit by a door.
Yeah.
It's spousal abuse. Your wife's been smacking you around.
Well, yeah. The herpes sore.
Well, at the very least, it's racist, certainly.
I agree. And there are some people saying, "Oh, it was a coincidence." I don't think it was a coincidence. I think it was horribly insensitive at the very least.
But you know what?
And flat out racist at the most.
Yeah, it was. Now, see, I see it as racist at the least and a little threatening at the most. I mean, you know, come on. You know, black people have been called monkey getting shot at in right wing newspaper. Hello, you don't think there's some crazy right wing fucking nut jobs out there hoping Obama gets shot? I mean, seriously,
I think they're there, and I don't think the cartoon is going to be the thing that's going to be pushing them over the edge.
But the cartoon might be the thing that's pushing them over the edge. That's just it. I mean, they may be 99% there. You know, they may see this as some message from the gods. Oh, my God, this means I have to kill Obama. You know, I mean, there's a lot of crazy people in this world. And
there are.
You know, and
50% of this show.
And all of them play Xbox and Wii, by the way. And
no, that was I took a Wii.
Anyway, you
know.
Too
many Wii jokes.
Clearly, the cartoon is racist. How far it goes is up to the individual, I guess.
Yeah. Well, in other Obama artwork news, I mean, I don't know if we want to extend the intro out here, but I want to bring something else up that's been irking me to high hell, to use an Ali G type of phrase, or Bruno. Bruno's the one who made the comparison to
it's like a weight that's pulling me up to heaven,
to the depths of heaven.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The other Obama art news. I'm sure you've seen this iconic poster, this posterized red, blue, and white, beige poster where it's like Obama's face, very posterized colors, and right below it, it says hope, right? Have you seen this picture?
Well, that's spoofing the one of Bush that used to say dope.
No, the dope one is
probably later.
This one is an iconic poster.
Can you prove it?
I could probably look at the timeline. But this one was done in like 2006.
Dude, you couldn't even tell me when Old English came about, and now you're going to tell me when an Obama poster
came
out?
In olden days. In days of yore.
That's probably true.
So there's this poster made by an artist called Shepard Fairey. He's a commercial artist, and also he is the guy who created the iconic Andre the Giant thing that you see all over the city. Have you seen that, where it's like a little stenciled Andre the Giant all over the place?
Anyways, no, I haven't.
It says Andre the Giant, and below it, it says Obey.
By the city, you mean what city?
Every city. Mostly in New York City it started, but it's been in a lot of cities. People have copied it. So it's like this viral thing for years,
Better than Kilroy was here?
Oh, way better. Andre the Giant, he kills Kilroy. So anyways, Shepard Fairey is this commercial artist and, you know, viral artist. And he endorsed Obama, and he wanted to create something that was iconic. So he created this poster, and it's brilliant because I think that it was just recently put into the American Art History or Art History Museum. Oh yeah, I gotta remember to wine. It was put into.
Oh, you never forget to wine. Believe me, I've heard nothing but that all day.
This poster was inducted, but the thing is, he was being essentially sued by the AP because he used as an original source photograph for the poster, an AP photo.
As if they could prove that. I mean, it was so he admits pixelized.
It.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. He clearly admits that he used that. But what he's saying is this is fair use. You know, this is a photograph, and I'm doing a stylized painting based on the guy's face just at that angle. It's not like he took the photograph and manipulated it.
It's a little Warhol-esque, don't you agree?
It's a lot Warhol-esque. But, yeah. But even more importantly, it's an artist who's adding his own thing. This is a fresh creation, and I think that for the AP to claim that there's copyright violation there, and they want a piece of every single use of this, by the way, the AP is saying that they want it's a copyright violation because he used the photograph as a source. Why?
Yeah, now that's bull.
I think it's really stretching it, man.
Yeah, and, you know, hopefully we'll have a little bit friendlier copyright, you know, intellectual property court system now. I mean, Bush, you know, passed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and all this bullshit that basically let corporations have their way all the time, you know.
Well, I think in this case there might be a conflict of interest if Obama got involved.
Well, whatever. I don't think Obama's going to get involved. And last I checked, he wasn't on the Supreme Court.
No, but he could file an amicus brief. But anyway, and the thing that disturbed me the most, really, about this entire thing was I heard the AP photographer. I mean, this is an artist himself, ostensibly. He's an artist himself going out there taking photographs, creating artwork. And I believe even if it's journalistic art, I believe he's creating artwork because he's framing the photograph. He's composing it. He's setting the lighting within the lens.
Photographers are artists. I get it.
He was interviewed by, I think it was Terry Gross on NPR.
All things considered, no, Terry Gross. What's her show called?
Fresh Air.
Fresh Air with Terry. I hate her theme. Theme song? Yeah,
well, it can happen.
It happens.
Yeah. So this artist, his photographer, I think his name is Manny Garcia.
Manny Sanguian.
No. He said, she asked him, this is the question, when you saw this photograph, did you know that it was yours? And he said, no, I didn't recognize, or when he saw the poster, he goes, I didn't recognize that it was sourced from my photograph. So there's piece of evidence one, that it really wasn't the original. And then piece of evidence two was, he said, she said, when you found out that it was sourced by your photograph, what did you think? And he said he was horribly disappointed that someone could just take anything off the internet and make it their own.
Oh, he said that?
Yeah. Hmm. It's like, wait a minute, he didn't take anything off the internet and make it his own. He saw a photograph of a face that he liked, and he then painted from it. That's like saying that the photographer took Obama's face and made it his own.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I don't buy it, man.
But speaking of that piece, yeah, you're right. The Hope poster came first, but then they did the stylized Bush version, the Warhol-esque Bush version, and it wrote dope on it. And the woman whose router I was hooking up the other day when I called you, she lives in Utica, and she on her front porch has the Dope poster.
Does she?
And it's whatever, affixed to her front screen door. And after the whole Iraqi shoe-throwing incident, I encouraged her to get some used shoes somewhere and, like, tape them to the poster and, like, have a smattering of shoes underneath the poster. So she started, like, sticking shoes. She found a way to make shoes adhere to the face of the Dope poster, and I thought it was kind of funny.
She should take, like, some spray paint and make him, like, a black eye and a mustache. And
like Kilroy.
Kilroy didn't have a black eye and mustache.
I don't know. He could, though. But then, you know, there'd be some sort of copyright infringement. And
of course.
All hell would break loose.
So anyways, I'm just saying that, you know.
I'm just saying.
The thing that really irked me on top of this copyright suit is that an artist himself would not defend a fellow artist in the creation of something new by acquiring things out in his environment and changing them for his own purposes.
Craziness.
Next thing you know, dogs and cats sleeping together.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All hell broke loose. We got a track. We got
we
a
do.
Tune. Let's check it out.
Settle in.
Yeah, check it out.
Oh,
the great Alan Holdsworth.
That was him. I couldn't tell, though, from the way he was playing.
No, there were absolutely no clues in his playing that that's Alan Holdsworth.
One of the more distinctive players.
But yeah, if you're a fan of Soft Machine or UK or Alan Holdsworth's solo music, you can tell his style from a mile away.
He's so distinctive that you can even tell when someone's trying to rip him off.
Yeah, that's right. John used to make I don't even remember this from like 15 years ago. He used to emulate, I think, the Alan Holdsworth UK sound. And to me, it sounded, John's impression of that was like a dentist drill. Yeah, that was it. Well, that was the great Alan Holdsworth on guitar from his first record, I.O.U.
Yes, you do.
Going all the way back to 1985. And that was Paul Williams on vocals, Paul Carmichael on bass, and Gary
Not
Husband.
Not the great Paul Williams?
Not the short little guy who was popular in the 70s. Who wrote that song Rainbow Connection in the Muppet movie?
That's true.
No, this is a different Paul Williams. And, of course, the great Gary Husband on drums. And once again, I haven't said this in a while, not pod safe. Yeah. We actually got permission from Alan Holdsworth, honestly, to play his stuff. So this is not pod safe music. It is commercial, copyrighted music that the great Alan Holdsworth was kind enough to let us use.
But I bet you he wouldn't have any problem if you tried to create music that was influenced by that. If you paid homage to him.
That's right. And I've met Alan Holdsworth, actually.
Yeah?
I have a picture to prove it, actually, somewhere. I have an autograph as well.
Are you bribing him with that picture? Is he, like, passed out in a hotel
room? He's passed out, drunk. There's dwarves everywhere.
Right. I'm keeping that photograph in a safe.
That's right. Which reminds me of a movie.
I call my Holdsworth every night.
It reminds me of a movie, The Bank Job.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Where they were holding the royal family hostage.
It was a decent movie.
I liked it. I thought it was better than decent.
I thought it was decent.
I thought it was better than decent.
I thought it was decent.
I mean, it wasn't in Bruges, but, you know.
But it was decent.
Yeah, it was all right. So, you know, you saw a movie last month.
I've seen several.
This particular movie, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. The Nader film.
Yeah, An Unreasonable Man.
Yep. I had it in my queue for the longest time, and then I finally decided to pull the trigger because every time a movie was up to go to my every time I returned a movie in my Netflix queue, I said, you know what? I'm not ready for that one, so I bumped it up. I bumped up something else, and then Nader – oh, there goes another Rossi. Nader ended up getting bumped down, and I said, you know what? It's time for me to pay Ralphie his due.
I've met him, by the way, as well.
Ralphie?
Yes, he spoke at
From
Hamilton.
From A Christmas Story?
He spoke at Hamilton College. And,
did he put his eye out?
I wish I had this thing, this little portable handheld recorder at that time, because I would have done a little question and answer with him, a little Q&A, as they say in the biz. I'm in the business, a little Q&A.
If anyone has grown up in the United States...
and I imagine most of our listeners are
within
US
the
citizens.
70s and the 80s, you can't help but know Ralph Nader and his
the
impact.
60s. No, well, 60s, the whole thing with the Corvair goes back to the early mid-60s anyway.
Right. And there was
I owned a Corvair once. Did you know that?
You showed me. I saw the Corvair.
Oh, okay. I didn't know.
I saw it in a barn. I didn't see it running.
Yeah, and I never got it running. I sold it and made money on it before. No, I did get it running.
It was purple, wasn't it?
It was purple, and it needed a new convertible top. And my dad and I got it running. We got it fired up.
Rear engine.
But then a
or
guy.
Mid-engine, whatever.
No, it was rear engine. A guy, the weight was behind the rear axle, like
okay.
the 911, which was the problem.
You really, definitely a rear engine.
Yeah. And somebody offered me money for it, like $1,000 more than I paid for it. And I went, you know what? It's going to take a lot of work to get this on the road. I can make a quick G right now.
Right.
All right. I'll take the quick G.
Besides, that car was definitely unsafe at any speed.
Well, I don't believe that because the 911 by Porsche is rear-engined as well. And if you know what you're doing and you can – if you know what to expect from the handling characteristics, you're going to be fine. But it's just that that weight in the back, it goes into oversteer very quickly.
I absolutely disagree with the statement it was unsafe at any speed because at zero, what's it going to do, explode spontaneously?
I don't know. It could have.
Well, anyways.
And just like the 911, it was a horizontally opposed air-cooled engine, the original 911s anyway.
So it was like a boxer engine.
It was a boxer, yeah.
So the movie that we're talking about, well, actually we haven't talked about yet, it's called An Unreasonable Man. It was a documentary about Ralph Nader, where he came from and what he's been doing, and from the period where he basically came onto the public scene all the way up until, what was it, the 2004 election?
Yeah, they talked about, I think the film was 2006 release, and you know, they talked about things as recent as the 2004 election.
Yeah, and what I mean, I was always aware
of... He ran in 08 as well.
Well, that's right. I was always aware of Ralph Nader, but the one thing that I wasn't aware of was how public he became and how quickly public he became because of the whole GM having him tailed and trying to seduce him with a woman in a grocery store.
Get the hookers to try to you know, get something on him and...
I mean, literally,
bodily fluids, I think, is what they wanted to get on him and then get a photo so they could discredit him. And,
right. Literally, they hired some sultry woman to go up to him in a grocery store and said, you know, hey, would you like to come back to my place and see my etchings?
Yeah.
And
he
said no, I mean, to his credit. And everyone was sort of insinuating that he's gay anyways.
Right. That was the next thing. Right. If we don't get him on the hooker, we can insinuate he's gay.
Right.
Clearly, anybody who wouldn't go out with a hooker and risk getting venereal disease has to be gay.
And I gained a lot of respect for the guy because I think he was one of the few people, if not the only person ever, to get GM, one of these large, multinational, huge corporations, to apologize under, like, congressional oath and say, you know, we're sorry for what we've done to Mr. Nader.
Well, okay, fine. We know there was some intrigue in Ralph's life. Let's just preface this by saying, and I guess we're beyond the preface at this point. We're chapter two. But Ralph Nader, responsible for safety belts in cars.
Yes.
Airbags.
Yes.
In cars. And these are all things. Safety belts between 1963 and 1985 saved something like 250,000 lives.
Yeah, airbags, the guy is directly responsible for millions of lives.
Airbags have saved, I forgot what the numbers were, but airbags have saved tens, it wasn't in the hundreds, but it was in the tens of thousands of lives. And people are trying to demonize this man because in the 2000 election, they're claiming it was his fault that Al Gore lost the election.
Right. And the thing that I just heard recently, and this was talking about like maybe weeks ago, where they said, I saw a statistic where it said something like 1 in 6 auto deaths where an airbag was deployed or supposed to have been deployed, 1 in 6 auto deaths was because the airbag failed or was not present because it was stolen. Now, what does that say?
Stealing airbags is a big thing, too, because they're expensive to replace, I guess. This is not the first time I've heard of this. I've heard of this a lot.
But what they're saying is if you've got 1 in 6 collisions causing an airbag or it's supposed to cause an airbag to deploy, and one of the six of those collisions results in a death that should not have been there, we're talking about millions of lives that this guy's saving and will be saving, you know, out to eternity if we're using automobiles. I mean, to me, that alone makes the guy a consumer's
saint?
Hero.
Yeah. Consumer advocate has been the phrase that they've used to describe people like him for a long time.
I consider him a consumer's hero, not just an advocate, because he put his own life essentially on the line. I mean, maybe not. I don't know if recently he's been threatened, but I'm sure that he sacrificed his entire career to doing stuff like this. You know, it doesn't seem like he's got much of a personal life, that's for sure.
Well, they certainly made that clear in the film.
Yeah, so I think that he's dedicated his life to saving lives. And
he's dedicated his life to consumer advocacy,
right.
And not just saving lives. He's done a lot. I mean, he lowered insurance rates in California for people. You know, it's not just about saving lives, as if that wouldn't be enough to make him, like, you know, qualify for sainthood.
Right.
But now we get to the 2000 election, right? Al Gore versus... W.
The first W.
Yeah. Well,
W and his first attempt.
That's right. W and his first incarnation. And because I think Mr. Gore lost the state of Florida, when the final count was done, and oh, by the way, the count was shut down by the Supreme Court before they were done counting, there were still plenty of ballots that needed to be scrutinized, hanging chads, blah, blah, blah.
Chad.
It was just one? It was Chad?
No, the plural of Chad is Chad.
There are plenty of hanging chads, C-H-A-D-Z.
It's Chazad, by the way.
It's our Jazab to say Chazad.
Oh, there you go.
And, right, he lost by like 537, I think, was the number of votes. And, of course, everybody's blaming the 9,600 votes or something like that Nader got in Florida for losing the Democrats' election. I mean, I'm convinced there was lots of chicanery going on in that election.
Oh, I'm sure.
But, okay—
As
you know,
there were in every election since the invention of the election.
George Bush's brother was the governor of the state. Hello. You know, okay, so now, but the thing that
it's
I find
It's not hard
intriguing,
evidence, by the way. But
no, it's not hard. It's just a fact, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, mind you, there were several candidates on the ticket in Florida, you know, Nader was not the only, quote, third party candidate. There were fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth and 13th party candidates as well.
Just have
and,
to say one thing before we go on about this.
Yeah.
I must reiterate something that I said a long time ago.
Walt Disney's head is frozen.
Still frozen.
Yeah.
Generalissimo Francisco Franco, still dead. No, what I meant to say is you should definitely, everyone should definitely see that movie Recount. It was an HBO film.
I haven't seen that.
That's where I got the line, Chad. That's I thought maybe you got that.
No, you know, what's the plural of stadium?
Stadia.
Stadia. Yeah.
So...
Not stadii, stadia.
Stadia. Okay, proceed. I'm sorry.
Every candidate who was not a major party candidate who was on the ballot in Florida got more than 537 votes. So they're foisting this defeat of Gore onto Nader, which to me is just it's so freaking evil. Again, this is a man who is since the early to mid 60s has done nothing but dedicate his life to bettering the consumer experience, basically.
Well, and he was
whether you're consuming cars or whether you're consuming car insurance, he's done nothing but dedicate his life to fighting the evil corporations. And, you know, I'm sorry, they are evil.
I was going to say that he was a reluctant candidate, and I think that what the film sort of pointed out was that he decided to become a candidate for president because it was kind of like a parallel to his fight against the large corporations. You've got these large, ginormous entities.
Monolithic.
Who are saying that this is the way it's going to be, and there are no advocates for the little guy who has an opinion that might deviate from that or a concern that deviates from that. And he's saying, look, you know, maybe this – and this isn't explicit. Maybe this is the same thing in our political system. We've got these giant monoliths, two of them, that are always going at it like Rock'em Sock'em robots, and nobody can get in between, and it's only A or B, and it's only right or left. There's nothing in between, and there's nothing that is completely independent of that, that has a chance. So he said, look, I'm going to run on the platform that these are independent ideas. Both of these large choices are bad, and I'm going to run because I have the right to run. I have the absolute right to run.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I have a huge problem with the argument that he is responsible for Gore losing. I mean, okay, let's first of all, what state was Gore from? Let's see, the great state
of Tennessee.
He didn't even win his own state. I mean, I know a lot of people jump on this and a lot of people are quick to criticize this particular argument, but he didn't win his own state. Every president wins his own state. I mean, come on.
What about every other state that he lost? He could have won other states too.
Right. So this isn't Nader's fault. I mean,
Al Gore didn't run the most spectacular campaign either.
He ran an awful campaign. And, you know, the more parties we have, and I probably have said this on the show before, but the more parties you have, the more democracy you have, or at least theoretically the more democracy you have. I mean, I'm a fan of the parliamentary system. I really think we should go to that system. But, you know, Nader helped put the Green Party on the map, first of all, right? Now they're on the ballot in all 50 states. They're the only third party that's, I believe, on the ballot in all 50 states. I don't know. The Libertarians may be on the party in all 50 states. Maybe Kirsten can help us with that. But, oops, my chestnut roasting on an open fire. Can you hear that? Yeah, that's a chestnut.
We'll edit that up.
Yeah. And no, we're going to keep that in there. It's a cool sound. But, yeah, I mean, he helped put the Green in, I believe his first running mate when he first ran in was it 96? Was it 2000 when he was running with the Greens? He ran as an independent in 04 and 08. But I'm not sure if he ran for the Greens in 96 or it was 2000. Winona LaDuc was his running mate that year.
I don't remember.
But nonetheless, he helped put the Green Party on the map. And as far as I'm concerned, again, the more parties you have, the more potential anyway for democracy you have, you know.
Even if those parties have no chance of really winning, and this is another thing that they showed, no real chance because of the current system. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have a chance to win. Even if they couldn't win, I believe their presence is important because at a debate, if they're allowed to get into the debate,
which they went into in great detail in the movie,
at a debate, at least they'll be able to bring up questions that people are going to be required to answer.
Absolutely. Or,
and I think that's
required to ignore, like a lot of politicians tend to do.
But if they, and that's an answer in and of itself. If you ignore someone's challenge, then you're shown to be a coward, just the way that they should be.
Absolutely.
So I think that everyone should be at these debates. So,
you know, my biggest disappointment in seeing this film was the writer for The Nation. His name is Eric Alterman. Do you remember that? I mean, I've read a lot of this guy. And it's so funny because Alterman is so progressive and gets so many things right, but his opinion on Nader is very divergent from his normal progressive
opinions. Because this guy lost.
Yeah, something like that. But I mean, do you know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, if you read Eric Alterman normally and you're a progressive like I am, you would normally think, well, this is a reasonable guy. But it's almost like his opinions on Nader are so divergent. They're like 180-degree diametrically opposed to what he normally thinks.
He may have been the guy who actually said that maybe his emotions are getting the better part of him.
I don't remember. But I mean, in the film, he accused Nader of being a megalomaniac for running. Now, after
that's
hearing,
a bit harsh.
Yeah, and after hearing all of his opinions and every bit of stuff that he had to say in this film, and in addition to the columns that I've read of his, he comes across as a megalomaniac to me in his espousing his opinion about Nader. You know, to me, he's the megalomaniac. What the freak are you thinking? Hello? We need more opinion. We need more points of view in this country,
Diversity of opinion.
Diversity of opinion. Thank you. And certainly Nader supplies that, you know, in addition to all the other parties. I mean,
and the
I
thing that's important
with,
about the system is that even if you disagree with the guy completely – he should be able to be at the party, or he should be able to be at the table discussing the things that you disagree with.
Other than the Republicans and the Democrats, I think the Green Party is probably the next biggest party in the country. I'm a registered Green, by the way. And he was not allowed to be in one of the debates. I don't remember if it was 04 or 2000, but
yeah, they showed him being quite a bit physically of that, kicked out.
Yeah, quite a bit of that was dedicated in the film. Time was dedicated in the film to that particular topic of him being excluded
threatening
from
him
the debates.
They're threatening him with arrest,
right?
Because he was just going to, and then this was to the point where he wasn't even allowed to be at the debate as a participant. But then someone donated a ticket to him just so that he could attend the debate.
Right. He was going to be in the crowd, nothing more.
Right. And they were going to threaten him. They were threatening him with arrest if he did not leave the grounds because he just wanted to attend the debate because he was going to be some sort of threat to the candidates.
Well, and he wasn't the only one excluded. Pat Buchanan was also excluded, which is ironic because they're so diametrically opposed in opinion.
But Pat Buchanan, he himself even said that, you know, that everyone should have been there. And
well, right. Well, Pat Buchanan, while being
somewhat logical occasionally.
You know, yeah. Pat Buchanan, while being a right-wing extremist and, you know, the guy, for example, has very, very divergent views from the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And he's an independent
thinker.
Disagreeing
with the war, for instance.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one of the prime examples. And he's a very independent thinker. And I used to love it when him and Michael Kinley were the hosts of Crossfire on CNN because there used to be some real stuff talked about then, you know, but there's not anymore.
He's a fiery guy, too. So, but anyways.
Yeah, and I still love Molly Ivins. She did a little article
once.
Yes, quite a while ago. But Molly Ivins was talking about Pat Buchanan's speech at like one of the Republican National Conventions 12 or 16 years ago. And it was very harsh, but she said it sounded much better in the original German.
I remember that.
I always got a kick out of Molly Ivins and that. But anyway, check out the film. I thought the film at the end of the day was actually very fair and cast Nader in a very fair light at the end of the day.
Yeah, because I think that they did, you know, take criticisms, it's, you know, showing how he basically could be a bit of a curmudgeon. He sacrificed everything. He didn't, you know, he would even turn on his own people if
his own people turned on him
if they disagreed with him.
The Nader Raiders the other guy, you know.
But the one thing that I did want to mention is that it was a clear demonstration of how people were putting this I don't know, it was like this almost maniacal look, and I don't want to use the megalomaniacal look, but this maniacal look at how Al Gore had to win, and anyone who was going to even take one sliver of that chance away became the enemy was Michael Moore. I mean, remember Michael Moore? They showed
clearly. Well, he turned his back. He was a huge fan of Nader and Ott, and in 04, he just completely threw him under the bus.
And they showed Michael Moore at this rally basically saying
they juxtaposed it with his speech from 4 years earlier.
Exactly.
And it was so hypocritical.
I'll let people watch that, but in a nutshell, it was he stood up and said, everyone has a right to run. Vote for this guy because of principle.
Vote your conscience.
Vote your conscience, not because of the party.
And then 4 years later, he was saying, don't go in the voting booth to feel good. Oh, I'm going to vote for Nader and feel good.
Right.
I don't want to
do that. Vote for the guy who's got the best chance to win.
Yeah, and I just think that's such bullshit. And, you know, I think the final my final thought on this topic is this. Ever since I've been an adult, and by that I mean...
Since when?
By that I mean of legal voting
Tonight,
age.
Tonight, you mean?
No, by that I mean of legal voting age.
Okay.
Everybody's been saying, this is the most important election ever in the history of the country.
They're all important.
And we need to vote Democrat. We just can't have the Republicans in. And if we keep being... This is a way the two-party system holds us hostage. And if we keep believing that idea that this is the most important election ever and we must defeat the Republicans, we need to get these third parties, the fourth parties, the 23rd... I mean, I looked at the number of parties that exist in Germany. It's something like 23. There are only five that are significant that have, you know, 7 to 10% of the registered voters. Or I don't quite know how their system works, but there are 23 parties of substance in Germany, and it's like, hello, we have essentially two and a third. We have the Green Party.
For all intents and purposes, we have two.
We do. And Nader's right on that. There aren't that many significant differences between the Republicans and Democrats.
Well, Nader's opinion is we have one,
the corporate party.
Right.
That's what
he would say. And they're both essentially, you know, two sides of the same coin.
And I agree with him. But
coin,
you know,
being the operative phrase.
We're being held hostage by the two-party system, and we need to get more democracy in this country. And I think more democracy means more parties. And again, I would prefer a parliamentary system where, for example, if the Greens got 7% of the vote for president, that means they get 7% of the House of Representatives. You know, that means 7% of the House gets to be Green Party. I mean, that's the kind of – to me, that's democracy. You know, well, real democracy would be referendums and us voting on every decision that ever got made. Maybe that's not manageable. There's a lot of people who are by default, you know, they're implicitly arguing that, well, that couldn't happen in this country. We have too many people. Well, we've never tried it, so we don't know. So I don't buy that argument.
But
at the very least, a parliamentary government would be democracy for me.
I don't know if that would happen in our lifetimes, but I think that
something to strive for.
I think that at the very least, we should have at least, you know, three or four parties being at every single debate.
How about 13 or 14?
Well, at least let's start, you know, baby steps. We should have at least three or four parties at every single debate.
More than the Dems and the Repubs, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think everyone should be at every single debate up until the very day that people are pulling that lever.
Absolutely. All right. We got another track. Oh, it's one of my favorite artists in the world.
Ever.
Let's check it out. That was the great. I keep saying great. I prefaced Alan Holder with great a million times. That was the great.
Fantastic.
That was the amazing and fantabulous Simon Fox.
Spectacular.
Who's one of our certainly one of my favorite artists. I can't speak for John, but Simon Fox. That was a song called Burlington, and we first played something on one of our first shows, actually, and fell in love with it. I did, anyway. Fell in love with this guy's compositions and style, and I developed a bit of a friendship with Simon over the internet, and this guy has been kind enough to let us play. And I mean, I just left an email yesterday, and I said, Simon, I'd love to play your song Burlington. Oh, go ahead, Rich. I'd love to help support your podcast. That was his reply.
Excellent. Unlike some people who say, you know, I'm afraid to have music played.
Yeah, there's this guy on YouTube that I discovered. I won't name names. Classical guitarist. He's just so not into
having
us. What
does his name
rhyme
with? No, don't.
Children.
No.
Rhymes with children, roughly. Okay. That's his last name. Anyway, not going to talk about a movie today since we kind of already talked about a movie.
We're running long.
Yeah, we're running a little, except John. He's a little short, but yeah, it's a personal problem. And I don't know. What do we got? I think it's the end of the show.
Took a while to hit that button.
Yeah, because the volumes kept going down. What's up with that?
Well, I don't want to get too technical here, but it's the Framus and the Condibulator.
It's the Rototamblertilator, I think.
Yeah, well, you know what happens when you do that.
The thing with the stuff.
Yeah.
To quote you. Anyway, this is Rich Wilgus.
And John Tallarico.
We've done a show of substance, and this is the first show we've done in a while that I felt had substance.
Our next show is going to be about boobies.
Okay, the frat boy thing. Anyway, check us out on the web. www.bloodyveg.com.
And please send us all sorts of feedback.
Which we haven't been getting.
Mostly good. Feedback@bloodyveg.com.
And if you're on iTunes, review us. Good, bad, indifferent, whatever.
Ugly.
And
That's it.
Thinking. Nader. Boobies. Anyway.
You're confused.
You've been listening to the VIB.